Good Monday. This is Ozarks at Large for September 13th, 2021 on KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. It's Welcoming Week in Northwest Arkansas. Later this hour, we find out just what that means and how Engage, NWA, and partners are working to make inclusion an everyday part of the region. That's in roughly 15 minutes. Just ahead, what the new Texas law limiting abortions means for Arkansas. Ozarks at Large's Matthew Moore has that report, beginning in about 4 minutes. The number of new cases of COVID-19 diagnosed in Arkansas this weekend, for Saturday and Sunday reporting, totals more than 2,800. Another 68 deaths were counted during the weekend. Just more than 14,100 shots were given Friday and Saturday, and there were reductions in hospitalizations because of the virus, 31, and patients requiring ventilation, a drop of 29. 7,267 Arkansans are known to have died from COVID-19 in the past 18 months. Governor Asa Hutchinson is defending his criticism of President Joe Biden's vaccine mandates for large employers. Last Thursday, the president announced all businesses with more than 100 employees must require workers to get vaccinated or take weekly tests for the virus. Speaking to a national audience on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday, Governor Hutchinson said the president's plan undercuts states' individual approaches to boosting vaccination rates.
The problem is that I'm trying to overcome resistance, but the president's actions in a mandate hardens the resistance. And we talked about the fact that we've historically had vaccination requirements in schools, but those have always come at the state level, never at the national level.
The governor said he wasn't sure if the president's new vaccination plan is constitutional or not. He said the president's plan would only further the divisions brought on by the COVID-19 pandemic.
This is an unprecedented assumption of federal mandate authority that really disrupts and divides the country. It divides our partnership between the federal government and the states, and it increases the division in terms of vaccination when we should all be together.
President Biden's vaccination plan also requires federal employees, contractors, and healthcare workers at facilities that receive federal funding to be vaccinated with no option to have weekly testing. The plan's vaccine and testing requirement for employees of large companies is estimated to apply to roughly 80 million workers across the country. The head of the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce says he does not anticipate that group taking a formal stand on the president's executive order. State Chamber President Randy Zook told Talk Business and Politics this weekend there is a mixed reaction among business owners in the state, some saying the move is a federal overreach, others thinking the executive order takes pressure off of them. A grant of $1.63 million from the National Science Foundation will help connect faculty from several institutions, including the University of Arkansas, to help facilitate data collection and analysis of both the role of organizations and social movements on politics and policy, as well as study the relationship between COVID-19 and black trauma. We plan to have more about the grant and the work it will inspire on an upcoming edition of Ozarks at Large. SWEPCO is generating power from a new wind facility. A press release from the utility says the 287-megawatt Maverick facility located southwest of Enid, Oklahoma, is now producing power for customers in Arkansas and Oklahoma. It is the second of three wind operations to power up. An earlier facility began operating in April, and the utility expects the third to begin operating in 2022. Special elections are set for tomorrow in a pair of Benton County communities. Voters in Pea Ridge will determine whether to issue bonds for street work and improvements and whether there should be a new 1% sales tax to repay the bond and provide more capital for the city. In Garfield, voters are deciding if a half-cent sales tax for water system improvements should be permanent. Polls are open tomorrow from 7:30 to 7:30. The Arkansas Razorback football team is ranked in the Associated Press Top 25 poll for the first time since 2016. May have heard, the Razorbacks defeated Texas Saturday night in Fayetteville. Arkansas is ranked 20th in the latest AP poll, 24th in the new USA Today coaches poll. Partly cloudy tonight, lows in the upper 60s and lower 70s across the region. Slight chance of rain tomorrow afternoon with highs from 88 to 90. We'll be right back. This is Ozarks at Large. A law in Texas has banned abortion after 6 weeks into pregnancy. The U.S. Supreme Court refused to strike down the law, and now those who are seeking abortions after that six-week period are going to neighboring states, including Arkansas. Ozarks at Large's Matthew Moore spoke with the director of one of the two clinics in Arkansas about the Texas law and more.
SB 8 is a law that has effectively made it illegal to get an abortion after 6 weeks in the state of Texas. And according to Holly Dixon, the executive director of ACLU Arkansas, it's wreaking havoc across the nation.
It prohibits patients from accessing care they need if they're around 6 weeks pregnant by allowing anyone, even with zero connection to the patient, to file suit against a healthcare provider or anyone who assists that patient in accessing abortion-related care.
As written, the law authorizes any citizen other than a government official to sue anyone who provides an abortion or helps someone obtain an abortion after that six-week time frame. That includes everyone, from the doctor who works at the clinic, to the Uber driver who took a pregnant woman to the clinic, to an individual who may have given money that is being used to pay for the procedure. The patients themselves cannot be sued, though. The state is offering at least $10,000 to individuals upon proof of such a violation.
So allowing complete strangers to sue clergy or a friend who gave a ride or providers to collect $10,000 for any patient who may be assisted in getting an abortion past 6 weeks in the state of Texas.
It's worth taking note of the eccentricities of pregnancy and how weeks are counted. Here's Lori Williams, a nurse practitioner and the clinic director at Little Rock Family Planning Services, one of only two clinics in the state that currently offers abortion procedures.
So 6 weeks of pregnancy, it actually refers to 6 weeks since the woman's last menstrual period. But this is only 2 weeks after the woman presumably would have missed her period. So it's an extremely narrow window at which a woman would have to discover she's pregnant. Many women have irregular periods or miss their periods for all kinds of reasons. Stress, diet changes, all kinds of things could make a woman miss her period. And to only have 2 weeks' time to discover that, find an abortion clinic, make a decision, and make a plan to obtain this care is just an extraordinarily narrow window.
SB 8 was signed into law by Texas Governor Greg Abbott in May, with a law going into effect September 1st.
As soon as the law went into effect, we started receiving phone calls and inquiries from Texas patients about our availability, and we are already seeing patients who are traveling from Texas to obtain this care.
And are we talking about, like, just folks from East Texas? Or are we talking about all across the state?
It has been a variety. I mean, many patients initially came from the Dallas metro area, but we have seen patients from as far as Houston and even further south who have made the distance and traveled this far to obtain care here in Arkansas.
The drive from Houston to Little Rock is around 7 hours one way. And as the law stands in Arkansas, a woman obtaining an abortion here has to have two separate visits. The woman must get an ultrasound and meet with a physician during the first appointment, and then wait 72 hours before obtaining an abortion.
It definitely has made it more difficult to provide the care that our patients need. The travel distance, the arranging time off work, child care, all of these factors influence a woman's ability to obtain an abortion. And with this law affecting Texas women, it's that much more magnified.
The added expense of having to travel a significant distance on two different occasions is a major burden. Allie Taylor is the president of Arkansas Abortion Support Network, a nonprofit that reduces barriers to abortion access to Arkansans. She says Texans aren't the only ones leaving their state to get abortion access.
Arkansans have been leaving the state for years to access abortion services, and knowing ahead of time what the impact of SB 8 would be. It is not surprising to me to hear that people are driving 8 hours to access abortion. It should stun anybody else who's not familiar with this landscape. And it is, I think it's absolutely despicable that our government is putting people in this position, that state governments are putting people in the position. So while it's not surprising to me, it is reprehensible and should not be the case.
State Senator Jason Raypert tweeted recently that he plans to order a bill be filed in Arkansas that will mirror the exact language of SB 8 in Texas. The Arkansas legislature has been a welcoming body to limiting abortion access in recent sessions. Many other states have discussed the idea of doing the same thing, but Holly Dixon from ACLU Arkansas takes issue with the idea that citizens actually want this kind of legislation passed.
These are extremist politicians within those states that want to pass these bans. This Texas law is widely unpopular.
Public Policy Polling released a survey in April while the bill was still in the legislature, and a majority of those polled opposed this bill. Just 10% of respondents believed that this abortion bill should be the top priority in the Texas legislature.
People in general do not support more restrictions on abortion. Politicians do.
Lori Williams of Little Rock Family Planning Services says that if a bill mirroring SB 8 were to pass in Arkansas, it would be devastating.
It would eliminate almost completely their ability to obtain care, and it would be devastating to women all over Arkansas and throughout the region.
Allie Taylor of Arkansas Abortion Support Network says they are prepared to do what their sister organizations are doing in Texas, which is helping support local women who need to cross state lines. In fact, the organization has already had to do it for one client all the way into Illinois.
We actually do have clients who we've supported going to Granite City, Illinois. So that's already happening.
What would you say to politicians in Arkansas who view abortion as murder and want to make it as difficult to get one here as it is in Texas?
Well, they need to mind their own business. They need to support policies that create healthy families and healthy individuals and let people make their own medical decisions.
U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland has sued the state of Texas over SB 8, calling the law clearly unconstitutional under longstanding Supreme Court precedent. A case from Mississippi on abortion challenging the precedent of Roe v. Wade is expected to be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court this fall. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Matthew Moore.
An Arkansan who disappeared in July 1944 while on a fighter sweep of Austria as a pilot in the United States Air Force has been identified through DNA analysis, and his body is being brought back to Arkansas. Lieutenant Henry Donald Mitchell of Harmon was in the number two position when his P-38 disappeared in the summer of 1944. Governor Asa Hutchinson is directing the United States and Arkansas flags to fly at half-staff until sunset tomorrow evening as a tribute to the sacrifice Lieutenant Mitchell gave to his country. The Oklahoma State Department of Health reports nearly 7,400 new cases of COVID-19 in combined testing data for Saturday, Sunday, and today. Since Friday morning, there have been 70 additional deaths from the virus reported. There are now 9,566 known deaths from the disease in Oklahoma.
KUAF is supported by Hendricks College, offering engaged learning by linking classrooms to the world and developing career skills throughout its curriculum. Hendricks graduates pursue medical, law, and other advanced degrees, preparing students to lead lives of accomplishment. Hendricks.edu/connect for more information. Roots-driven, alternative rock band Counting Crows, with opening guests Sean Barna and Matt Suchez, come to Walmart Amp in Rogers Saturday, September 18th. Counting Crows hits include Mr. Jones, Accidentally in Love, and more. AmpTickets.com or 443-5600 for tickets and more information.
Still to come on this Monday edition of Ozarks, Baseball Hall of Famer and Arkansas native Brooks Robinson is the subject of our Prior Center profile. Randy Dixon will be with us ahead. And in less than a minute, what it means to stage a welcoming week and include everybody you can. As this region continues to grow, working to make more people included We talk about the 2021 Welcoming Week just ahead.
When you start your day with NPR's Morning Edition on KUAF, you never know where you might wake up.
I'm Steve Inskeep in Islamabad.
Carrie Khan, NPR News, Lakai, Haiti.
Lauren Freyer, NPR News, in Deoband, India.
And these dispatches come from reporters you know, trust, and rely on. Our commitment to global reporting is one of the reasons you listen to KUAF, and it's the reason we need your financial support. Help keep intelligent analysis and objective reporting there for your mornings with your contribution to KUAF. Just go to supportkuaf.com and thank you.
This is Ozarks at Large. We are in the middle of Welcoming Week NWA 2021. This is an effort across the region to allow residents to build connections within their diverse communities, to help refugees from around the world, and to take other welcoming actions. For 11 days, because this week starts and ends with weekends, there are opportunities for new residents to learn more about their adopted home and for people who've lived here for some time to learn more about new neighbors. Welcoming Week actually started last Thursday night, but there are still 7 more days of online and in-person events. Those in-person events, of course, have nods to safety. Engage NWA is facilitating Welcoming Week and has partners like Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, the Bentonville Film Festival, the Fayetteville Public Library, Walton Art Center, and others. Last Friday, we reached Margot LeMaster, the Executive Director of Engage NWA, and Monica Kumar, a Belonging and Inclusion Strategist, by Zoom to discuss Welcoming Week. Margot says the 11 days are designed to inspire welcoming behavior year-round.
In terms of the activity and involvement and engagement that we see around Welcoming Week, absolutely, we want to see that transition to longer-term commitments, really building relationships and connections across the community.
Can you find out through an event like this what else is happening that even maybe you don't know about or that could help, you know, people who don't feel included or say, what about this?
One is sign the pledge, because that is a really, it's a simple but very effective and instrumental sort of stake in the ground to say, hey, this is something that's really important to us as a company or an organization. The other one is participate in the projects that we have. And, you know, you can go on our website and see an entire roster of projects that go all the way from virtual at home and family friendly through to socially distanced, safe, but in real life. And then the third piece is kind of what you're getting at. We really want people to lead projects. So if anybody has seen, and this has happened throughout our preparation, that, hey, we're doing something or we would love to do something and we don't see it in your list or we don't know how to quite plug in, there's a Google form, you just click on lead, there's a Google form you can fill out, super, super simple, and we will find a way. If you think that it fits into welcoming, it does. And so we will find a way to make sure that we're supporting you to do that.
You've both mentioned the pledge. Let's talk just a little bit about that, signing the pledge. What does that pledge say?
The Northwest Arkansas Leadership Pledge was launched in the summer of 2020 by the Northwest Arkansas Council. And quickly, we saw many organizations and companies from across the region sign on and commit to that pledge, which is essentially to create a more just, equitable, and inclusive Northwest Arkansas region. So to date, we have around 200 companies and organizations that have signed the pledge, and it's really a commitment to action. It's, you know, it's not just we're signing the pledge and we have our logo on the website, but it's really what are the clear, concrete steps that we're going to take to fulfill our commitment to that pledge. And when it comes to Welcoming Week, this is a great way to be able to take action, to be able to, if you don't have, those relationships, to start developing those relationships and making those connections so that this can continue to become part of your normal, that these types of activities are part of your normal and your company culture.
Front of mind.
Yes.
If you look at me, I check all the boxes of someone. I've lived in Northwest Arkansas for 40 years, Arkansas for more than 55. I'm a straight white guy. I'll charitably say middle-aged, but someone who has been here a long time and is most likely to not understand as well what it's like to be from somewhere else or a minority or underrepresented culture. What can people who are like me do, not just in welcoming week, but think about over the course of the next 12 months to make sure that everyone's included.
I love that you asked that. Thank you. And I think that this is where belonging really shines, because every single human, every human spirit, every person, and let's stick to North West Arkansas, every white male over 40-ish, I'm going to be generous, Kyle, around 40-ish, has felt this way. You know what it feels like to be excluded. You know what it feels like to feel like you're on the periphery of something. And it really doesn't matter if you are the majority culture and you check every majority culture box. There is a time, whether it's at work or whether it's at home or whether it's, you know, when you're out socializing even, that you know what it feels like to not be included. And you know what it feels like to be excluded and to be othered. And I think the very first thing whenever anybody talks about starting on the journey of thinking about diversity, equity, and inclusion and belonging, my first thing is don't do it for someone else. Figure out your why. Because if you don't have skin in the game personally, then it's always going to be something that you put on the bottom of your to-do list because you'll get around to it because it's not for you. And this is just not true. The fact is that the more and more we fracture into smaller us's and smaller we's, we are literally seeing the impact of that. It's not a positive impact. You know, I think that the COVID has really shown us that when we don't build a community where we can feel truly included, we feel really isolated, and it's very clear what it means to feel excluded. You know, the pandemic of loneliness is at the root cause of so many of these things that we're talking about. And I know, Kyle, you can't tell me that never in your life have you felt lonely. And I know you have lots of friends, and I know you have, you know, a partner that's far more wonderful than you are. And yet still, we all know what it feels like to feel lonely. So I would say figure out your why first. And when you figure out your why, whether that is for your kids, because you want them to grow up in a world where isolation is not a major part of their experience, or it's because you understand that your neighbors are different from you and you want to connect with them because that's going to make your neighborhood safer and a more wonderful place to live in. Figure out your own why. I can, you know, I have hundreds of my own whys, and they're all related to me. They really have nothing to do with anybody else. And because they're related to me, it's a driver. It makes me so passionate about wanting to go out and be a part of inclusion and be a part of welcoming because it's for me. I would say start with your own why.
All right. This isn't fair because you're just now starting 2021, but ideally 2022 welcoming week. We're not in a pandemic. We can all be together. Have you allowed yourself this short way into 2021, what 2022 welcoming might be like?
I think that already seeing just how much just this year, how many projects are on the list, how many organizations and companies have stepped up to participate has been overwhelmingly wonderful. And I think that just kind of gives us a hint, kind of gives us a peek into what 2022 could bring for us. We'll want to, you know, always saying you can never start early enough. And, you know, you asked about 2022. Well, we could start planning for 2022 now, and it wouldn't be too early because there's just so many ways to activate, so many ways to connect across the region in this work. And Monica, I don't know if you have anything you want to add to that.
Yeah, I'm, you know, three specific examples, really. One is I reached out in a very small way to our Bentonville and regional students. And Marco and I were overwhelmed. One, because they came up with this idea that, hey, can we have some sort of way of writing little kind notes, which one demonstrates how small the act can be, but two, how much big impact it can have. So we just created these little postcards. I don't know that Margot or I really thought much of it, but yes, you know, a couple of days ago, we got photos of hundreds of students that had completed these cards. And, you know, some of them you can read, which is just they're really aimed to I think, for new students or people that are new to their neighborhoods, to give it to them and say, hey, you know, don't be scared. I've been in your shoes. You're going to love, you know, you're going to love this region. You're going to love this school. Let me know if you need anything. So I think activating young people for me is always a passion, but that has just got me really, really excited. The second piece, of course, that I'll speak to is Canopy. You know, we're at a very critical time, and I would be remiss if I didn't mention that today it's, you know, September 10th, which is the eve anniversary of September 11th. And, you know, and that just brings up really strong emotions for me. And I think about how our community has pulled together to support Canopy, especially in light of some of the Afghanistani families and individuals that are going to come into our region. We just met with Mariah this morning from Canopy, and she said it's been almost overwhelming how students, again, young people, and also our community has responded. And we have a couple of drive-by collection projects with Canopy that you can find on the website. That you can just, you know, go to Walmart or, you know, or shop in your house, you know, fill up the list, and then just safely from your car, give the welcoming kits. And then the third piece that I'm really proud of is that Bentonville Film Festival, you know, that happened, Bentonville Film Festival happened like a couple of weeks before we started activating Welcoming Week. And I've always felt like the community hasn't really had an opportunity to take advantage of some of the absolutely outstanding film that they produce. And luckily, the Bentonville Film Foundation feels exactly the same way. And so they curated a list of movies. I mean, most of their movies touch on diversity and belonging and inclusion, but they curated a list that really fell into the welcoming space. It's a very diverse, incredibly deep and meaningful list. And they gave us a free Welcoming Week film pass. So all you have to do is go into the toolkit or go on the website, you know, click on any movie, any film experience, and there's information on page 5, I believe, to register for a free pass. And then you can watch them from the comfort of your own home. Most of them are family friendly. The one that I'm super excited about is our last one, because it's called Americanish, and it's focused on young Muslim women having the diverse experience of being American and Muslim and the cultural kind of balance that they have to have. And then it'll be followed by a live panel with one of the actors, the filmmaker, the director, all for Welcoming Week. And that makes me really excited that we across the board have young people engaging. We have, you know, folks like the Bentonville Film Festival engaging. And then we also have Canopy that we can really support the outstanding work they're doing. That's just this year. Right. So, yes, my vision is really, really big for next year.
Well, one thing I want to say is just a thank you to our incredible sponsors, Walmart and Walton Family Foundation, stepped up to support Welcoming Week this year. And just, we, you know, they've made it very clear that this is important to them, that this is a priority for them. And we just, you know, we wouldn't be able to do this work without that support. So we definitely want to share our gratitude for that.
Yeah. And I want to share where you can go to get, you know, to kind of learn more about it. So if you go to www.engagenwa.org, /Welcoming Week NWA, it'll direct you to the toolkit, it'll direct you to the list of events, and every event is clickable and you'll get more details on it. And then, you know, one of the things that we're having a lot of fun with is our I Am a Welcomer photo sort of challenge. And we're just having, you know, again, in the on the website, you can find the link, you can print off an I am a welcomer in you know, your chosen language, or there's a blank one that you can write your own language. And we're just having people in the community take photos of themselves and share them across their social media channels. And that's been really fun to see, because it's really nice to see people openly, you know, openly be welcoming.
Monica Kumar is a belonging and inclusion strategist. She spoke with us Friday morning, as did Margo LeMaster, the executive director of Engage NWA. Again, schedules and much more about Welcoming Week NWA can be found at engagenwa.org/Welcoming Week NWA. And we have that link available as well at OzarksAtLarge.com.
I'm Scott Tong. Half of transgender people report being mistreated by medical professionals. We'll talk with a patient who was considering a colonoscopy.
The gastroenterologist was asking some really unnecessary questions about my sex life, and I ended up canceling the procedure.
That is next time on Here and Now.
Here and Now, today at 1 on KUAF, and available streaming on the upgraded KUAF app. The Writers' Colony at Derry Hollow in Eureka Springs is hosting its final summer Words in the Garden literary reading series with an open mic event Wednesday evening beginning at 4:30 inside the Carnegie Library Garden on Spring Street. Michelle Hannon is executive director at the Writers' Colony,
where we provide uninterrupted writing time for writers of all backgrounds, genres, and levels of experience. And we also offer literary events and workshops, and we offer fellowships, all kinds of things, but with a literary bent, and our mission is all about nurturing writers.
The Writers' Colony routinely hosted free public monthly potlucks, branded Poetlucks, where colony writers and others could share their work. Hannon says the gatherings have temporarily ceased because of the pandemic. The final Words in the Garden event of the season is open to a dozen budding and professional writers to share their work for up to 5 minutes each.
And I've got a sign-up sheet. We've got time for 12 writers, and there's lots of space left. And I would encourage anyone who is interested in reading, even if you haven't done it before, this is a great way, a great place to do it. It's a very supportive, encouraging audience, and it's a lovely setting.
Registration is not required, but those wishing to present should arrive a bit early to sign up for a time slot. To learn more, you can go to writerscolony.org/events. The nonprofit colony aims to nurture diverse writers of all genres, backgrounds, and levels of experience in a supportive environment that they say builds community, energizes creative expression, stimulates new thinking, and optimizes productivity. Since opening its doors in 2000, the Writers' Colony has hosted 1,700 writers from 48 states and 13 countries. And just ahead on Ozarks, after last week's ceremonies in Cooperstown, New York, to induct new members of the Baseball Hall of Fame, we're going to revisit a Pryor Center profile from the summer of 2020, when Randy Dixon, with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History, shared archives relating to Arkansas native and Hall of Famer Brooks Robinson.
The 5th Annual International Festival at the Botanical Garden of the Ozarks is Sunday, September 19th from 2 to 6 p.m. This free event is a part of Welcoming Week and includes traditional dance performances from around the world and ethnic food available for purchase. Blankets and lawn chairs welcome. RSVP at bgozarks.org. Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Bentonville offers the perfect summer destination to experience art, architecture, and 120 acres of Ozark nature. Visitors can explore the galleries, walk the trails, or participate in art-making programs. More information at crystalbridges.org.
This is Ozarks at Large.
Number 5, Brooks Robinson.
If you are a baseball fan, that sound probably makes you very nostalgic for the times when we had baseball. It is a cut introducing Brooks Robinson when he was a Baltimore Oriole, and it comes to us from the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History, one of the digitized archives that we're going to hear today because Randy Dixon is on the phone with me from his home. Randy is with the Pryor Center. How are you doing, Randy?
Great, Kyle. How are you?
Very good. I love these segments. We get to hear digitized archives that have been provided to the Pryor Center from KATV in Little Rock, made possible through a gift from the Tyson family.
That's right, and I love doing these. It's great to research them and find all this and come on and talk with you every week.
Well, Brooks Robinson was one of the best third basemen in baseball history, a native of Central Arkansas, and at the time when he was with the Baltimore Orioles, that was one of, if not the most storied franchises at that time.
Well, and he played with them his entire 23-year major league career.
Right.
He was there from 55 to 77. And, of course, while he was there, they won two World Series.
Including the 1966 series when they swept the Los Angeles Dodgers. And we have some content from Brooks talking about that, don't we?
Well, we found footage from 1966. There was a big homecoming for him. And he came back to Arkansas after the World Series win, and he was greeted at the airport. It was a huge crowd of people that included some notables. Bud Campbell from KATV talked to him, but then also, Bill Dickey and Billy Mitchell were there to greet him.
I certainly appreciate that. I tell you, a lot of nice things have happened to me, especially this year. But this is the nicest of all, coming home and being welcomed by people you've known all your life. And this is a high point in my career and a high point in my life.
Bill Dickey, a Hall of Famer, and a fellow who knows a real good baseball player when he sees one. I think, Bill, you're as proud of Brooks as everyone in Arkansas is, aren't you?
Bud, you're not kidding. Brooks, I want to say congratulations. We're all proud of you down here, and I know how you felt when you that final out of that World Series game, four straight.
Well, you're right, Bill. It was a great thrill, and I tell you, I was really glad to get those four out of the way. I didn't care about going back to Los Angeles to play anymore.
Billy Mitchell, I'm going to ask him to come in because Brooks, way back there, I know that you got part of your start anyway at the Boys Club. Bill, what capacity did Brooks figure in back in those days?
Well, he won some midget league championships for the Little Rock Boys Club, and I think played twice on the state midget league championship team for the Boys Club.
Haven't forgotten those days either.
No, I'm afraid not, but I tell you, I remember him very vividly, and Lamar Porterfield especially.
And you heard Billy Mitchell there talking about when Brooks Robinson played in what was called the Midget League. That was the actual name of it back in the...
It's not very politically correct these days.
40s and 50s. It was basically a little league, right?
Right, right. And they played at a field called Lamar Porter Field, and it was near downtown. And my dad, who was a few years older than him, told me years ago that he used to watch him. And he said even in Little League, he was an amazing player. He said people would flock there just to see Brooks Robinson as a kid.
Of course, when Brooksy was growing up, I mean, baseball, of course, is still big and important now. But when Brooksy was growing up, baseball was the American pastime. And he and his dad played, and they started not with a baseball, though. What? Tell me more about this.
Well, he'll explain here, but KATV talked to his dad and then his mom, but they play with a tennis ball, and he explains why.
Brooks Robinson Sr. remembers how it all began, and actually, Mr. Robinson, it began with a tennis ball, I think, didn't it?
That is right, Bud. When he was a small boy, we always had a tennis ball here, and we got out in the backyard and played catch with him, you know, and we was afraid to use a regular baseball. We were afraid it might injure him, you know. And so from then on, he just went on and played wherever he could.
The day before Brooks Jr. was born, where were you?
Well, I was at a ball game watching my husband play. He's played sports all through school, and we were at a ball game that night, and I was watching him play. And the next morning, I was in the hospital and had Brooks Jr.
Not that these things can be predestined before birth, but you're watching your young husband play baseball while you're about to give birth in 24 hours to your son who is going to become a baseball Hall of Famer.
It was karma.
Just a side note, KATV loved talking to the parents of famous Arkansans, didn't they? We've heard from Glenn Campbell's parents, Johnny Cash's parents.
That was kind of a theme, yeah. Jim Pitcock liked to do that. He liked to, you know, make it personal. And he would usually, if he could, talk to the parents of a, I guess, celebrity, if you would call it that, whether it was in sports or entertainment, he would try to find their parents and talk to them about, you know, their childhood.
Yeah. You know, if we've talked about the 66 series, of course, the Birds, the Orioles won the 1970 series against the Cincinnati Reds as well after being upset in 1969 by the amazing Mets. But in that 1970 series, Brooks was nothing short of amazing, especially with his glove. He did swing a mean bat, and we'll talk about that in a minute, I think. But he was renowned for what he could do with his glove at third base.
Oh, gosh. You know, as a kid, I used to watch him. He was easily my favorite baseball player. But it was sort of like, you know, when he would field a ball, it was like watching Nureyev
or Rishikov. Right.
Especially in the slow motion, you know, replays of him diving for a ball and then throwing it. But yeah, I mean, his nickname was the human vacuum cleaner, which I think is a terrible nickname personally, but Mr. Hoover.
And you've got a cut from his longtime, very famous baseball manager about him as a player.
Well, I guess his attitude and temperament are as about ideal for baseball or life in general as anybody could have in the position he's in. He loves his job. He loves to play baseball. He don't like to sit out a game. If he does have to sit out a ball game, he accepts it, and he's still part of the ball club. As far as work is concerned, as great a third baseman as he is and has been throughout the years, each night when he gets to the park and we take the field to go through our batting practice drill, he'll take his 30 or 40 ground balls and loosen himself up.
That's Earl Weaver, who sounds very calm.
Very nice, by the way, which wasn't always the case.
If you're unfamiliar with baseball lore, Earl Weaver was known as someone who would come out and yell at the umpire and kick dirt on him and turn his baseball.
Kick dirt on the shoes, yeah.
Right, right.
Yeah, he was pretty much a hothead, but you could tell he really felt a lot about Brooks and his character.
And Robinson, on those Orioles teams of the 60s and 70s, he was a superstar. He was beloved there, but he was not the only one. Frank Robinson, who, of course, won an MVP. You had pitchers like Jim Palmer. And speaking of slick defenders, Mark Belanger at shortstop. And then you had Boog Powell at first, this big, towering mountain of a baseball player.
Yes. And we have a little bit of an interview with him here about his, you know, even though he was known for playing third base, he was also a pretty darn good batter. He had a .267 average, almost 3,000 hits, and he had 268 home runs.
And so here's Boog Powell talking about Brooksy as a batter.
What about Brooks Robinson as a batter, Boog?
Well, I've seen Brooks now for, I guess this is my ninth full year in the big leagues, and overall I would have to say he's one of the best hitters that I've ever seen come along. Especially where our ball club is concerned. He's got so many big hits for us, it'd be just about impossible to stop and count them all. And it's meant a lot to me, too, as a hitter.
Now, what you're talking about is the ability to hit in the clutch.
Well, this is true. And he proved this again. I think the last series we had against the Yankees over there at home, he had a grand slam home run in the bottom of the ninth inning, which was a real big ball game for us. And it always seems when the big ball games are up there, Brooks is in there swinging the bat for us.
I'm talking with Randy Dixon, who is from the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. We're taking another stroll down Arkansas history's streets, and we're doing this one about Brooks Robinson, the all-time great baseball player born in Arkansas. Okay, so Randy, if there's a theme that we've had with some of these of talking to parents, there's another one, and that is the Arkansan done good coming back home.
Of course, it was nice that you were selected as Arkansas's Professional Athlete of the Year for the second time, but I guess one of the real big honors this winter would have to be that Hickok Award, wouldn't it?
Well, it sure was. It was a big thrill to me, mainly because it was more or less for the Pro Athlete of the Year, you know. And
in all sports.
In all sports, yes. And it's
a beautiful belt, and it looks like it is worth $10,000. I know I'm going to have to pay taxes on that, too, but it was a great honor to receive it, and I was with some great people there, and Bobby Orr, who plays for the Boston Bruins, and also George Blanda was there, and we really had a great night, and
It was terrific. I'm just very happy to receive it.
Is it some sort of a belt that you put in a trophy case? It's not the type of belt you could ever wear, is it?
No, you can wear it, yes. It's got a great front buckle, a great big front buckle on it. Then you could put it around you. But it wouldn't be, it has about 26 small diamonds and a large diamond in front with a sapphire and a ruby on each side. And a lot of it is gold, so I wouldn't be parading it around any place. I'd put it in a locked box, and that's where it is right now.
You heard him describing the belt. I want to see the belt. he won that year, 1970.
You know, if you go to Camden Yards now in Baltimore, you will be greeted by a huge number 5 that's outside of Camden Yards. That, of course, was Brooksy's number. And Brooks Robinson, and he hasn't played now for 43 years in Baltimore, he's still very much beloved in that city.
Yes, and still lives there. He stayed in Baltimore, but still loves Arkansas. He was back a couple of years ago when they renovated Lamar Porter Field, was there for the dedication. I don't think his health is great right now. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how much he travels, but, again, he still considers himself an Arkansan. And, his nickname, as you've mentioned several times, was Brooksy.
Yeah.
But in this clip, some people referred to him as Arky.
I heard somebody a moment ago before we came over here refer to you as Arky. So obviously, even though you live in Maryland now, Arkansas is still very much a part of you, and I know you're proud to contribute to our state by representing us so well in Major League Baseball.
Well, thank you. I've always been happy to be associated with Little Rock and Arkansas. And I tell you, the fellow who called me Arky was Joe Schultz, who's managing at Kansas City, and he was my second manager in professional baseball. And when I got there, I was 19 years old, and that's the name he pinned on me right off the bat was Arky, so I still hear that a lot. But, I kind of have in the back of my mind that one of these days I might get back to Arkansas. I really like the pace of things there more so than living in the East. But it's much easier living in Baltimore and when you play there, If I was playing someplace else, I might be living in Little Rock. But now that I've been in Baltimore for a long time and I haven't been traded, it's just much easier on your wife and family to stay in one place.
And if you want to hear more about him growing up in Arkansas, there's a book. Mm. I have it. It's an easy, good read, but it's called Third Base is My Home. Mm. And it's his autobiography.
There's another, there are several people in the Baseball Hall of Fame that were born in Arkansas, Lou Brock, Dizzy Dean, and one that I don't think you'd be able to find anything on, and that's Arky Vaughn, who was born in Clifty and starred for the Pittsburgh Pirates in the 1920s. Probably don't have anything digitized with Arky Vaughn, do you?
I'll look for it.
Well, all right. Don't be disappointed, though. Randy Dixon is with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. He visits with us almost every week with some of these great clips. And you can find these and much more if you Google Pryor Center and go through their website. Randy, if you'll have us, we'll let you come back and do another one.
Hey, if you'll have me, I'll be here.
It's a deal. Thanks, Randy.
As climate change intensifies, natural disasters are getting worse, destroying property, livelihoods, and people's spirits.
Weariness, frustration, and resignation, I think, that this just keeps happening.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. How the infrastructure bill could help climate resilience in Detroit. That's this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered this afternoon from 3 to 6 on KUAF and KUAF.com. This is Ozarks at Large. Some Fayetteville entertainment venues are implementing vaccination requirements for patrons. People attending the Walton Arts Center and Theater Squared must present proof of vaccination or a negative COVID-19 test before attending a show, organizers announced earlier this month. Theater Squared's executive director, Martin Miller, says the company already instituted a vaccine requirement for employees and performers in March.
Of course, actors, when they perform, cannot wear a mask unless you happen to be doing a play about people wearing masks. So after the emergence of the Delta variant, of course, some of our calculus changed and noted, of course, the high community transmission in Northwest Arkansas. We started to talk about further steps to make sure we are keeping our audience and artists safe.
He says ticket holders will receive information on how to confirm vaccination status prior to each show date, and those who are unable to comply with the safety protocols will be offered a live stream option.
Theater Squared has always been about access, so this is not in any way about preventing anyone from being able to come to the performance. That's why not only are we accepting proof of vaccination, but also someone's proof that they've just had a recent negative test.
Negative antigen tests must have been taken 72 hours prior to the performance date and must be printed. Miller says the response from the public has mostly been positive.
But we had also received a lot of feedback that among our audience, folks were looking for additional safety protocols to continue being comfortable coming to the theater. We certainly have had a few individuals who were angry, who were upset about the requirement. I've personally connected with several of them, and I think the fact that they better understand that, yes, you can just take a test and come into the theater, that's no problem, has helped in those conversations. We are not saying no to anyone who wants to come see a show.
He says the new policy will continue through at least the end of October. And make it 701 career wins for Jane Sargent, the head coach of the UAFS volleyball team. The Lions secured that milestone 700th win for their coach Friday morning with a straight set win over Albany State in a tournament in Georgia. Sargent, now in her 24th season at UAFS, is one of just more than 60 coaches to log as many as 700 victories. The Lions went 1-2 in the remaining games in Georgia, now 5-3 this year. UAFS will be in Lubbock Friday night for a match against Lubbock Christian. Arkansas volleyball now 8-1 after winning all three matches at a weekend tournament in Tulsa. Up next, another tournament later this week, this one in North Carolina. And JBU volleyball won 2 of 3 tournament matches this weekend in Missouri and will host Wayland Baptist Friday night in Bill George Arena. Arkansas soccer is working on a 4-match winning streak after blanking Lamar 6-0 in San Antonio yesterday. Next, the SEC opener against Tennessee Friday night at 7 in Fayetteville. And JBU women's soccer now 3-1 after a 2-1 loss to Lindsey Wilson College Saturday. The JBU men now 2-2 after a pair of losses this weekend. JBU men will host number 2 Oklahoma Wesleyan tomorrow afternoon at 4 at Alumni Field in Siloam Springs. The JBU women are home Saturday morning at 11, hosting Bethel.
Support for KUAF comes from Tyson Foods, which has called Northwest Arkansas home for nearly a century. Today, Tyson's more than 24,000 team members in Arkansas come together from across the state and around the world to help feed the nation. More at TysonFoods.com. The Hillberry Harvest Moon Music and Camping Festival is October 7th through the 10th at The Farm in Eureka Springs, and KUAF is giving you the chance to win tickets. Hillberry welcomes Railroad Earth, Arkansas, Opal Agafia, and more. Registration and additional information available at KUAF.com.
This is KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Boonville. KUAF is a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas, and you can listen to us anytime, anywhere, through the updated free KUAF app. Timothy Dennis produced today's show. Contributors included Matthew Moore, Jacqueline Froelich, who delivered information about the Words in the Garden Wednesday night event in Eureka Springs, Daniel Carruth, who provided information about Theater Squared, and Randy Dixon from the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. Randy back with us next Monday for a brand new trip through Pryor Center archives. Additional content this Monday provided by the newsroom at KUAR, public radio for Little Rock and Central Arkansas. Our theme is titled First Hurrah. It is written and performed by Daryl Sean. From the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio in downtown Fayetteville, I'm Kyle Kellums. Please be safe. We're back with you tomorrow at noon and 7 p.m. for a brand new show.